Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast from Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, join writer and researcher Madeline Potter for a deeply personal and timely conversation about her acclaimed book, The Roma, a powerful portrait of Europe's Romani communities, past and present. Recorded live at the 2025 Festival, Potter offers a moving exploration of identity, resilience, and the importance of visibility.
Welcome, everybody, to Bradford Literature Festival. Thank you to the organisers, to all of you, to the city, for welcoming us here this afternoon. We have with us, lucky for us, Madeline Potter. Maddie grew up in post-communist Romania. She now lives in Scotland and is a scholar of 19th century literature at the University of Edinburgh, having earned her PhD from the University of York in 2022. And this is a proof copy, the beautiful finished copy is there, is The Roma, A Travelling History, which is Maddie's debut book, which we're here to talk about today. Before we do, I'd like to read some quotes about this book from early readers and reviewers, which I can vouch for the accuracy of. An exhilarating history of resistance and survival of a people who have refused to be defined by their persecutions. That's from The Observer. It's also been called a book that will inspire and inform, a brilliant and vital exploration, heartbreaking and hopeful, wise and beautiful, epic in scale and ambition, fascinating, dark and surprising. Berdisha has praised its rigour, its love for heritage, and calls it evocative and intriguing, to be treasured. It redefines what it is to be the Romani gypsy other, enchanting, says the poet Karen Downs Barton. So on that basis and others that will become clear, I would invite you to welcome Maddie with a round of applause.
Thank you so much, Damien, for that lovely introduction, and thank you everyone for being here. It's a real pleasure to take part, and I want to thank the organisers and thank the city of Bradford and everybody who's come here today.
I wanted to start, Maddie, by asking you to talk a bit about a word which you highlight the importance of at the start of the book, and that's the Romani word vitsa, or vitsi, some people say, because you and I are both from the Roma or the Romani community, but yeah. What that actually means can be, I mean, Romani as a word arguably is a bit like saying I'm European or I'm South American. Exactly. It can mean unity, it can also mean difference.
100%. We have this tendency to think of the Roma as an ethnic group, but that's kind of inaccurate, because really Roma is this really big umbrella term that refers to all of those groups that left India roughly the 11th century. But those groups have spread. They've settled in different countries. They've traveled through different countries. They've developed their own individual cultures, and they've got their own histories. Obviously, there are things that hold us all together, but there's great diversity. So Roma is that big umbrella term. And then we've got the Nazia, which is like a nation. And there are some big ones, such as the Gitanos in Spain. And then within the Nazias, we've got the Vitsa, which I suppose could be best translated as clan or subgroup. So it refers to a particular almost confederation of Romani people that are held together by a history. So I'm part of a Vitsa that belongs to the Caldarash, who are very widely spread among the Balkans and in Romania, where I grew up. But there are other Vitsas, such as the Romanichals, also known as Romani Gypsies here in Britain. There are Lovara people, who were traditionally horse traders in Hungary. So there are loads of different Vitsas, or Vitsi, which is the plural in some dialects of the Romani language, each of them having their own specific traditions, their own specific culture. And I think it's really important for us to have those discussions about that, diversity within that big Romani identity. I should also say that Roma in the Romani language is a plural noun. It means men or husbands, and Romani is an adjective. So I'm using them a bit like that in the book, broadly speaking, taking this kind of technical approach, partly because different groups prefer different terminologies as well. So I went for the technical solution.
I was going to ask this later, but since you've come to it naturally, I mean, I thought it'd be good to ask you to elaborate a bit on these words and why the words, for instance, the word gypsy is controversial, but also why the word Romani can be confusing because it sounds like Romanian.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on these words?
Yeah. So gypsy is a really, really interesting one. It's controversial because some groups consider it a slur, particularly in North America. So Romani people in North America tend to be very, very cautious about using it. They really dislike it. Whereas, and I think Damien is able to speak because you are Romani child, it's a term preferred by many people here who grew up in the tradition. Part of the reason why it's controversial, it's because it stems from a misunderstanding. It's short for Egyptian. When the Roma arrived into Britain, they were initially mistaken for Egyptian, and then Egyptian became gypsy, when actually the Roma came from northern India. So some people said, and some Romani people said, well, that means Europeans saw us and assumed that anybody who didn't look European would have been Egyptian, and there we go. We don't know exactly why the Egyptian confusion happened, but I think looking at the research that I've done for this book, what's interesting to see is that the term Egyptian comes up in connection to different Romani groups in different countries. So the term gitano, and pardon my pronunciation, but in Spanish, that shares the same etymology with gypsy. It's short for Egyptian. Agupti in Bulgarian, they're a subgroup of the Romani people, that translates as Egyptian. I found some documents even in Romania, and in Romania, it's not common to refer to Romani people as Egyptians today, but I found a document that historically did refer to them as Egypti, so Egyptians again. So it's quite likely that there's some legend that they had that they would have spent time in Egypt. It's quite likely they would have said something about Egypt themselves. Now, Romani culture is an oral culture. We don't have written records of this. But so it's quite possible that the whole Egyptian thing did come from within Romani communities. So is it an exonym that, so is it a term that's been applied by someone from outside of the community? Or is it a term that actually arose from the community? We don't really know that in the absence of those written records. That means that different groups will react really differently to it. It's also been used to translate other terms in other languages that are more clearly slurs. So the term Tigan in Romanian, that is quite likely derived etymologically from untouchable. It was used to refer to Romani slaves because in Romania, Romani people suffered from chattel slavery for nearly 500 years. And that is applied as a slur. But in the absence of a better word, really, that word has broadly been translated into English as gypsy, which has led some Romani people from Romania or from the Balkans to perceive gypsy as a slur, even though its history in Britain doesn't necessarily reflect that. And again, because there's so much diversity among Romani groups, how people react to particular words is going to differ. And different people will prefer different terms for themselves. So yeah, that's kind of the controversy in a nutshell surrounding the word gypsy.
Explained with brilliant concision. thank you. I'd have made a pig's ear of that, I think. This book, I think it's important to say, is part of something which really exciting, which is happening in literature, in English, I think, which is that people are creating new genres, really, out of blending genre. And I hope that you might agree that that's a fitting thing to say about it, because in here you have history, you have memoir, you have travelogue, you have historiography. So you're telling history, but also reflecting on the way that history has been told. There's emotion and there's confessional in here as well. Is that something that came to you naturally as a sort of formal approach, or did you sort of think about that in a structured planning way before you went about it?
Yeah, and I fully agree that it's very hybrid. I mean, when I went to Hatchards in London to do a stock signing, they were very, very confused, and they asked me, what category do we put it in? European history? Do we put it in travel writing? And they decided to put a few of the books in travel writing, a few of the books in European history. So they're actually sort of spread out. And then in Waterstones, they wanted to put in world history. So all these decisions, I think, speak to that sense of hybridity when it comes to genre.
It's like a metaphor for the confusion around Romani identity.
Exactly, yeah. I think the approach was very clear to me from the start, because we've had some books, so we've had books written about Romani history from what I would call a Gajo perspective. Gajo, in a dialect of the Romani language, means someone who's non-Romani. And we've had brilliantly researched books on the topic, still written from an outsider's perspective. And they're lacking particularly that sense of Romani identity. We do have records of Romani people arriving into Europe. In Romania, one of the earliest records of Romani presence relates to them being sold as slaves. But we can absolutely trace the migration, the timeline of the movements of Romani people all the way from India through to Britain and even North America by looking at these records. They tell us where Romani people went, but they never told us what life would have really been like for them. There's a lot of misunderstanding, as we were just saying, about Romani identity. And that does come from Romani identities being flattened and not being listened to and not being uncovered. So to me, it was clear that Romani history includes all the traditions, all the folk tales, all the experiences. And as Damien really brilliantly put it, that history happens to people, that it's not just something that happens chronologically, but that people live these histories. And that includes me. That includes me living as a Romani woman growing up in Romania, living in Britain for a while now, and moving through these spaces. So it's very clear to me that I wanted to have that sense of orality, of the culture, of the movement, to pay tribute to the history of nomadism, but also to understand my own movement through Europe, my own migration to Britain as someone who is Romani, and how that has shaped me. So I wanted that richness of culture to be there. So I wanted to humanize these dates, these chronicles. I wanted to show the stories behind the Egyptians Act that Henry VIII passed, trying to banish all Romani people from Britain, or the stories behind the Romani Holocaust, known as the Samudaripen, Pen, or the stories behind Maria Theresia trying to extinguish Romani culture in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. I wanted to show what life would have been like for Romani people through reconstructing this sense of Romani identity. So I think in that sense, it could never have just been a classic history book that starts and just moves chronologically, because I think that doesn't capture all that variety and diversity of Romani experiences and the richness of the oral culture.
But I think what you've identified is that what we see as a classic history book had arguably a great flaw, which was the reluctance, or even if it wasn't reluctance, the failure to identify individuals that we could connect with. And I think that recent revisionist, or I don't want to say revisionist, accurate Black histories of Britain, for instance, are bringing out these individuals. And I think that's something that you do brilliantly.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mentioned this in the book, is as cliche as it might sound, history is written by the winners. History has a perspective. We take history at face value because we read that this happened in 1865. But we forget that history is often about interpretation, that we're given a particular version of history that then is presented as objective.
Yeah. You mentioned the Holocaust, or Samudaripe, some people call it the all-killing. Another word for it that you explain in here is poraimos, or devouring.
Devouring, yeah.
And I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit, but perhaps with reference to how slow the recognition of it has been and the way that memorials to the Romani Holocaust are being treated and have been treated.
Yeah, so the Roma and Sinti, and I'm going to go briefly to the question that we began with. The Sinti are a subgroup of the Romani people who are speculated to have come from the province of Sindh in India. They prefer the term Sinti to refer to themselves, but on a technical level, they are still part of those people who left India as part of the same migration. So technically, they are part of the Romani people. But because they prefer the term Sinti for themselves, in Germany, the official terminology is Roma and Sinti. So the Roma and Sinti were the other group, apart from the Jewish population, who were targeted by the Nazis for the final solution, for ultimate extinction. My own family, some members of my own family, perished in the Samudaripe. But recognition has been incredibly slow. There were no Roma and Sinti witnesses called to testify the trials. There were voices in the 1950s that were saying, don't believe the gypsies, they're always lying. So the witness was being called into question. I also did mention that we have an oral culture, which meant that culture of bearing witness in the written form wasn't really there. In fact, actually, Romani writing can be said to have really, really emerged in the aftermath of that, with some testimonies, such as by, say, a Stoica or Otto Rosenberg, who survived it. And also, essentially, the conservative estimates were about 250,000 to 500,000. But because Nazi policy initially was quite muddled when it came to the Roma and Sinti, and because concentration camps didn't always keep records when it came to Romani and Sinti victims, some estimates place it at a much higher value as well. But it's estimated that up to 50% of Romani people, perished, the European Romani people. And There was little recognition of these Romani voices. I write in my book, for example, about the work that a Romani charity, Romano Lav, has been carrying out in Glasgow, and they unveiled a monument to the Romani Holocaust that was vandalized not once, not twice, but three times. The memorial to the murdered Roma and Sinti in Berlin is currently coming under structural threat because Deutsche Bahn, the German railways, are wanting to build a new line that would go straight underneath it, and that would endanger its structural integrity. So while progress is being made in terms of the recognition of it, there's been a lot of reluctance, and to this day, memory culture of bearing witness tends to be quite selective. So there was an online petition that called for people to sign this petition to stop this new rail line being built. But the fact that we're even having this conversation feels quite troubling.
Especially given that Deutsche Bahn was the company that shipped many Romani people to the concentration camp.
Exactly, yeah.
But this is, you don't focus solely on misery. I wouldn't want to give that impression, because as you say in the book, and you do it as well, you had a strong desire to remember Holocaust victims as people with complex and fulfilling lives. And you even paint at times some of the joy they managed to conjure in those places.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, and that was one discovery that I had while I was researching this book, that one thing that really holds all these witsy together is the sense of celebration of the culture. And that was something that I was very keen to bring out, because obviously Romani history is a history that has been very, very much marked by racism, marginalization, genocide, enslavement, and I could go on. But we still are here, and Romani people have always had this flair for celebration, for joy. When I launched my book at the Roma Cultural Center in Glasgow, we had a playlist full of Romani music, and it was an unusual book launch from that point of view. But we had to have that because the communities always love to get together, to tell stories, to laugh, to boast a little bit about everything. And that was something that was happening even in Auschwitz, right? And that's something that other eyewitnesses found a little bit disturbing. So we have, for example, a written account from a Jewish doctor who was forced to work in the Zigeunerlager, so the gypsy camp, for lack of a better translation, where she was observing the Romani prisoners basically joking and boasting about their wealth from before the camps. And she found that really baffling. And I can see why. I can try to put myself in an outsider's perspective and understand that that would seem baffling. But at the same time, to me, as a Romani person, that makes perfect sense because it's all about what we call pakiv, which is something like you could call it social capital that is to do with community coming together. And that sense of boasting is not just vapid or nonsensical, look at me. But it usually arises in situations that are to do with crisis, that sends a message that I'm here to protect you, that because I had wealth before I was sent to Auschwitz, that means I was someone big in the community. That means I'm still someone who matters in the community, and that means I can provide some protection and preserve that community even in those circumstances. So that's the thought process that would have happened. That's the kind of cultural cohesion that would have happened. And one of the issues with the Romani genocide, the Samdaripa and the Poraimos, being so marginalized in discourse is not only to do with, obviously, with reparations, obviously to do with the memorials, but also to do with cultural specificity when it comes to these experiences. And I think that's really important. So I think those ways of resisting culturally, of surviving it culturally, of preserving what's called Romani pen, which is Romani-ness, I guess you'd best translate it. I think those are important discussions to be had. And I think, obviously, the Holocaust is a particularly tragic example, but we can find such instances throughout Romani history, such as, for example, in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, when Maria Theresia tried to forcibly settle the Roma, we have accounts of how they were given some shacks, some barracks to live in, and they put the cattle in there and they still lived in their tents. And then they fed the corn that they were given to sow, which would have tied them to land, that would have turned them into an agricultural society. They gave them to the cattle to eat. So these sometimes quite funny ways of resisting that persecution and those attempts to destroy the culture and to destroy us, the people, in loads of ways.
I found that fascinating, that it's one of those thoughts I feel like I should have had before, but hadn't really. This book does that a lot. That boasting, you can only boast if you're doing okay. And so to do it when you're not doing okay implies that you'll be okay again.
Yeah.
And you also write about the castellos or the castles, which are sort of these grandiose dwellings that some Romani people have built in Romania and some other countries. But there's often a treatment in the media of these as if they're uniquely crass and tasteless.
Yes.
As though other people aren't capable of that kind of... How do you view that sort of treatment?
Yeah. I think they're really, really interesting. They essentially, first of all, they speak of a traditionally nomadic culture growing roots, right? So replacing the roots, the traveling roots, with the roots that grow in the ground, because what's more rooted than architecture? They're really interesting in terms of architectural style because they blend Indian with Middle Eastern and vernacular Romanian elements. So in a way, they speak of how the Roma have moved through these cultural spaces and how their cultural memory has been shaped by them. And yes, they are very opulent because Romani culture does value those displays of opulence, those displays of aesthetics. But they have been treated in the media in Romania with utter contempt. They ruin the architectural landscape. They're very tacky. There were speculations that people don't even live in them, that there's this stereotype about Romani people being dirty, which actually, if you grow up in a traditional Romani community, you know how absolutely precise we are about cleanliness and purity laws. So they were speculating that oh, you know, they were just building these palaces, but then living in filth outside of them. So there's this kind of cultural contempt when it comes to Romani ways of cultural expression. So the castellos, the palaces, have been in my book, contains some photos as well. And I was very happy to be able to include a photo of the castellos themselves. And you see, I mean, you're not going to be able to see from here anyway. But I think that they're really interesting. And I think that this contempt of, I remember at some point they were being compared to something from Beetlejuice, which, yeah. I think they should be valued as part of a diverse cultural landscape. And I would love to see some here in Britain as well.
Well,
if we get planning permission, we should start building them.
Watch this space.
Yes.
Some of my relatives have got some ideas about that. But you mentioned there's a blend in some of these buildings of styles of architecture that link the East and the West, if you like, or, you know, the subcontinent with Europe. And I wanted to ask you about, because I think this comes across powerfully in this book, as it must, about how the history of racialization, colorism, you know, division in Europe actually prevents people from seeing their common history and the ways in which they overlap culturally. And it really complicates how we're able to feel about our home countries at times.
Yeah, and I write in my book, I have a very, very complicated relationship with Romania, partly because growing up there, I suffered from a lot of racism. I suffered from a lot of marginalization. I suffered from police violence while reading in the park, and this is something I write about in the book. I was approached by a policeman who asked me what I was doing. I said, I'm reading. You people don't read, so what are you actually doing? And he proceeds to assault me physically. And just a lot of existing as a Romani person in Romania, and racism against Romani people tends to be very, very vicious in Eastern Europe to this day.
Do you think people are aware of that outside of those countries, really, like how embedded it is and how you'll be presumed to be Roma if you look Roma and you're not as well as a foreign visitor?
Absolutely. I've seen British Indians and British Pakistanis being mistaken for Roma in Bucharest and suffering racial abuse by being called gypsies. So anybody of a slightly darker complexion is presumed to be Roma, sometimes rightly, sometimes wrongly. I don't think, this was one thing that surprised me actually in Britain, was how little awareness there was at a collective level of the racism that Romani people do suffer from in Eastern Europe. And I think it's really important because if we take, for example, the Ukrainian crisis, the war, there were the Romani refugees were being segregated in the countries that were receiving refugees. So Romania, Poland segregated some of these children. There were Romani women being pushed off trains when the war started because they would steal. And I did wonder, say, let's just for the sake of discussion assume that they would steal, which is not true. But say for the sake of discussion, there were people who would have rather left them to die. They were fleeing literal war. So there were people who would rather let them to die than have their pockets potentially picked, right? And that is the kind of situation that Romani people do face in Eastern Europe. And I was quite surprised of how little awareness there was surrounding that in Britain. I think more discussions are happening now, which is great, but I think there's still a lot more awareness to be raised.
Mentioning stealing makes me think about the myth of gypsies stealing children, of which, I mean, don't take my word for it. Professor Thomas Acton, formerly professor of Romani studies in the University of Greenwich, will inform you that there is not a single recorded instance in history of this actually having been proven to have occurred. But there are occasionally moral panics around this, like the panic around the stolen blonde angel of Greece, Maria, a few years ago, who it turned out was a Romani child.
Yeah.
I always find this shocking as a blue-eyed Romani person, this assumption that you can't be of that heritage. But what you bring to the fore in here is the real history, which is of attempts to eradicate Romani culture by removing children from their parents.
Exactly. It's actually quite the reverse of it. There's the stereotype of the child-stealing gypsy, when in fact, traditionally, Romani people have had their children ripped away from them, sometimes placed in state institutions, such as was happening in France. But even, and this feels very local, it feels very important here, last year, the Hare Hills riot was sparked by social services removing a child from a Romani family. And this is something that has happened throughout history. Romani people have had children removed from them. There was a whole, and I touch upon this, a very difficult subject to write about in the book, a whole black market of babies being adopted with the scare quotes around in Romania and Bulgaria after the fall of communism, where usually white middle-class American couples who were struggling to conceive would go to buy a baby. And although the practice wasn't particularly racially focused in and of itself, it is going to be the group that is most vulnerable that is going to suffer more. So estimates suggest that the up to 30% or even higher, or even a higher percentage of those babies who were sold were Romani. And these families were tricked. They were told sometimes that your child has to go to the States to have surgery for a condition and they will be brought back. Romani people have been excluded from education, so they were given documents that they couldn't read to sign under the pretense of the child needs life-saving surgery, when they were actually unwittingly signing adoption papers.
It felt appropriate to let that silence hang there for a moment, and it's kind of stunned me briefly to the extent that I feel like I want to move on to music. because that's a huge part of this book, as it must be, because music is such an important phenomenon, survival tool, job for so many Roma people. And I wondered if you might speak a bit about this idea of Romani people as brilliant musicians, but as just preservers of tradition rather than as creators or as real musical geniuses.
Yeah.
Compared to someone like Liszt, who you write about, who is undoubtedly seen as a genius.
Yeah.
But the story is more complicated.
It is more complicated. One thing that was really interesting to me was, and I think this speaks of the cultural counterpart to the personal tradition that I am going to bring up in a moment, is that the word Roma itself is likely derived from, and I'm not going to pronounce this correctly, but the Hindu Dharma. One of the theories surrounding the origins of the Roma is that we are descended from a Dalit or so-called untouchable caste, which still exists in India today, with several subcastes, or the Dharma people, and some of them were traditionally traveling musicians. And that stunned me, because that's us, essentially. So this is a practice that goes back all the way, that the Romani people have carried with them for a millennium and a half since they left India, and that they've continued to cultivate. This is an assiduous cultural practice. It's not something that comes out of nowhere. It's not something that, as some stereotypes have it, is in our blood, we're just born with it. No, it's something that's culturally cultivated and personally cultivated. My friend, growing up in Romania and part of the community, started playing the violin when he was 3. So it is something that the people learn to do as they learn to walk. It's something that people cultivate as a second nature, and they usually learn from their parents, from the father. It's something that develops our second nature, something that's cultivated, something that takes tremendous amount of practice, hours upon hours upon hours, of developing that skill, of developing that ear, of developing the craft of the violin or the voice or various, you know, the dance as well, because I write about the flamenco dancer Carmen Amaya. All these things people grow up with and practice, practice, practice. It's not something that just comes out of some kind of, I don't know, gypsy magic.
Well, this idea of bohemianism, not in the sense of Bohemia, the country that was, but of that to be a gypsy is to be somehow free in a way that other people aren't able to be free. And you trace that back to the French poet Baudelaire, but really there's an unbroken tradition to Fleetwood Mac and beyond.
Shakira.
So, but what do we think of that? Is that entirely pernicious or dangerous, or is there something sort of harmlessly attractive about it?
I think that's quite dangerous. I always say to people who think that Romani culture is free-spirited that they should go spend 2 weeks with the traditional Caldarache community in Romania and see just how free-spirited they are, because they have very, very, very strict cultural laws that dictate pretty much every single aspect of life as it's lived. And often in nomadism, and it's a beautiful tradition, and my community, Romanian communities, were forcibly settled. So I didn't grow up with the nomadic lifestyle or with any real memories of it. And it's something that I have felt I culturally mourn. But at the same time, nomadism is not easy, right? If you look into these accounts, there were Romani rights activists who were begging to be settled because life on the road is difficult. It's exposing. What do you do in the winter in Scotland, for example, but in Sweden, for example, as well, that there's a considerable Romani presence in Scandinavia. It's a tough life. And this fashion of bohemianism, this fashion, so idea of the free-spirited Romani person, I think doesn't take into account those hardships on the road. It doesn't take into account the cultural practices. Pretty much everything that you would see a traditional Romani person wear has cultural significance. The skirts that you might have seen traditional Romani women wear, they are a cultural expression, because in traditional Romani culture, the lower part of the body is considered impure, so needs to be covered all the time. So there's a reason why the skirts are long. And then there's little awareness of this when people kind of take that idea of the gypsy. I think it's also created in the Romani scholar Ian Hancock writes brilliantly about how it's reinforced the idea that this is not a racialized group, but that anybody can be a gypsy because it's about lifestyle. And he talks about, this was something that I was struggling to convey when recording my audiobook, because he writing gypsy with a capital G as gypsy with a small g, which makes sense on paper, but try to read that out in the audiobook, reinforces these ideas that it's about lifestyle rather than about being a racialized group. And that erases the racism that Romani people face. So I think, that's quite an important one. I've had a woman tell me that I should see her collection of gypsy skirts and the caravan that she built in her backyard. When I very gently pushed back against some of the stereotypes, she accused me of ruining her fantasy of a wild people.
Interestingly, I've had a tendency to describe some of my relatives as a bit wild, but I think I mean something slightly different when I use the word. Something that you mention in here, and I think it's connected to all that really, is that more than once people have said to you about your academic career that it's brilliant that you've managed to make something of yourself despite being a Romani person. Yeah. And I wondered, just to turn that on its head into a positive possibility,
yeah,
what we think of the idea that actually you've achieved things because you're Roma.
Exactly.
I've thought about that a lot.
Yeah, and I know that is such an important thing, I think, to bring up, isn't it? There seems to be this idea that Romani culture is divorced from education, that we don't value education. But all those folk tales, all that musical culture, all everything, the folklore, that's education. It's just oral education. It's not the same type of education that the people know, broadly speaking. So the idea that I've managed to get a PhD despite being Roma, to me, is ridiculous, because I think, what would better prepare you for a PhD in literature than growing up with storytelling, right? What would better prepare you to teach than reading out loud to members of my community and trying to explain what I made of those stories to the younger ones? I think Romani culture has really helped me get where I am right now in my career in very, very significant ways. And I think that's a really, really, really important distinction to make. It's not despite it, it's because it.
I mean, we were talking before this event about how verbal recall is a really prized skill and ability. The ability to say, no, you didn't say that, you said this, you used this word. And I think that that's incredibly helpful if you've cultivated that in academia.
Exactly.
That's just one example.
Yeah, and writing and publishing, yeah.
In the chapter on Spain, there's a wonderful moment where you compare two women flamenco dancers.
Yeah.
One of whom you've seen dance in what we'd see as really stereotypical flamenco, so the full dress that would be depicted on a Spanish postcard, and someone else wearing her normal clothes.
Yeah.
And it struck me as a powerful metaphor for kind of Romani stereotype versus reality. But what was it like experiencing different flamenco in different environments?
Yeah, so I went to a performance in Madrid and it was brilliant, but it was so professional. I was looking around me and I was feeling very uncomfortable because I was very clearly the only Romani person in the audience. And I was feeling, okay, this is because the Romani culture is, as I said, people grow up with the music, people grow up with family, with community. Extended family is huge, I think, for pretty much all Romani groups, from what I've seen. So the fact that it was so professionalized, it was on the one hand brilliant because it was great to see so many people come to that event to see and to appreciate that form of Romani cultural expression. And that was amazing. But it also felt somehow a little bit un-Romani because of that, because it was so curated, so sleek, so clean and nice and fancy. And it was great and it was beautiful. But I wanted to find the grassroots flamenco. I wanted to see if people still did it at community level, spontaneously, within family settings. So I went to Seville because I thought I'd probably have a better chance finding it there than in Madrid. And I went to a bunch of performances in Seville as well, and they were brilliant again. But then I thought, okay, this is still not that spontaneous outburst of the music, of the dance. And then my husband and I were just walking around the neighborhood of Triana, which is historically known to host significant community, Romani community. And I was so tired and it was so hot and my feet were swollen and I just wanted to go back to the hotel at that point. And then we randomly walked into a bar because we heard some music and there it was. There were two Roms, two Romani men just strumming. One of them was just on the guitar, the other one was singing. And then the woman who was working behind the bar started dancing and she was just wearing her day-to-day unassuming clothes. She was at work and then she started dancing and then she brought me to dance as well. She just moved some tables out of the way to create a dance floor. And that was it. It was not curated. It was not, I don't think, It was not that professionalized, amazing experience, but it was that community setting. It was them just being there and doing it while sipping on a sangria, and that was brilliant.
Flamenco is, I don't want to call it a stereotype, it's a powerful totemic culture and image of Romani people, but obviously unites them as well with North African culture, with Mediterranean culture, the Ladino Jewish culture of Spain as well, and Spanish culture. We've talked about child stealing being a complete myth, which it is. But what, something that isn't a myth but is a powerful image is that of the Romani fortune teller.
Yeah.
And this is a practice which for a lot of people is their occupation. Yeah. It's still banned in most states of the United States under old witchcraft laws.
I think one of them's just been repealed very recently, but yeah.
But I wondered if you might talk a bit about fortune telling and what it means really to us.
Yeah, and it's again one of those stereotypes that, and I my academic work tends to be in Gothic literature, so the texts that I read and teach and write about are often riddled with these sort of famous one. Wuthering Heights, Heathcliff, who's described as a gypsy, is also described as the son of the fortune teller. So just shove that in there. So yes, it is a stereotype in terms of it being associated with this old gypsy hag just throwing a curse upon anybody unfortunate enough to cross her path, which again, I think that is caricaturing a real cultural practice. Fortune telling is still very much practiced among traditional Romani communities. There are various ways. So there's palmistry. There's in Romania, some communities use a little, it's like a shell that you look into and read it. Also cartomancy, so tarot, but also other types of card reading. But they do go back to Vedic astrology. And they do go back to, again, these things are quite important because they're passed down the family line. There's no such thing as Romani fortune telling. Not only do they differ from Witzer to Witzer, they often differ from family to family. Yeah. So there's this thing called bloodline practice. And the secrets are supposed to be inherited, usually on a maternal line, not always, not exclusively, but usually like that. And it's also become a really important symbol for Romani feminism today, where Romani women reclaim that stereotype to feel empowered and to create spaces where women can come together and forge this space of articulating what Romani feminism is, which is a whole different discussion, I think.
But, well, could we briefly, before I open to the floor for some questions, I did think it was an important question to ask you, Maddie, given your position, what you've written about, what you make of the balance between the growth, you know, the very essential, urgent growth of Romani feminism over against the media appetite to jump on anything they can accuse Romani people of. One of those things being, oh, it's a sexist culture as well. How do you approach those ideas?
Yeah, I think it's important to acknowledge the challenges, but push against the stereotypes. I don't think, so often young Romani girls presented with an either or choice. You either give up your culture or there's going to be no space for you in the mainstream educational system or so on and so forth. Whereas I think we should be celebrating Romani culture, celebrating the folk tales, the traditions that we have, while also creating public ways for Romani women. And I write in my book, I want to see long colorful skirts in lecture halls and in the parliament. So I want that tradition to be made part of public life. I got married relatively young. I got married before I started my PhD, and yet I did my PhD. And I don't think those things have to be separate from each other. I think we should, as a society, create these spaces for discussion, for understanding of the culture beyond the stereotypes, and creating spaces for young Romani women to thrive in.
Amen. are there any questions? We've got about 7 or 8 minutes I think, and I'm sure some of you must have them.
Are there any particular aspects of Romani culture that you feel the rest of the country could really value and learn from?
Yes, absolutely. I know there was a Romani music performance here a couple of days ago. I don't know if people went to it, but yeah, definitely I would say the music would, I would love to see it shared more widely. So always, people always welcome to partake in Romani music. I recommend Manele. I write about them in my book. And I think it's safe to say that everybody could learn from that sense of joyfulness and celebration of us laughing. I use the metaphor of looking the devil in the eye and mocking him. I think just sense of resilience and having fun in the face of disaster, I think that's something that we should share with everyone else and that everybody else should, I think, partake in.
That's what normally happens when Romani people gather. They don't normally have a really serious discussion about the Holocaust. And
so, never. Like,
we have to do that. But yeah, absolutely. Are there any others? Yeah.
Are there any cultural habits you can link back to India? Or like the Indian people had a close knit where they go, well, stick together, close knit. And they're quite clever, crafty in handling the situation where your community has been a bit weak in this, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously because we've been traditionally nomadic and scattered, and because there's been so much marginalization and persecution, there's still clusters forming in terms of community cohesion, but also in terms of, yeah, discussing and kind of forming a closer connection with Indian communities as well. I know a few years ago there was a discussion, there was a delegation that went from, I can't remember, I think it was probably Slovakia to India to discuss this. So it's still ongoing that the Indian government might recognize the Roma officially as diaspora and offer passports to people because some Romani people in Europe suffer from statelessness. So these are ongoing discussions. And I think it's, because if you take Romania, there was very little immigration when I was growing up. So in a way, many people were not that aware of that connection. But coming to Britain, you have discussions and you notice the cultural commonalities. And I think that's starting to grow a little bit. But I think it's an ongoing process. I hope that kind of answers the question.
Are there any more questions? There's one here at the back.
Hello. I'm currently working with a group of Roma women from the Czech-Slovakian sort of like heritage, and it's been so great. I've been learning so much myself because I'm Pakistani, and to my shame, I didn't know much about the Roma community until I worked with them, and learning, sort of hearing some of the Roma words as well. There's a lot in common.
Yeah.
So it's been a big learning curve. So thank you for being here and sharing a bit more.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah, so I really liked your differentiation of like Roma, Romani. And I was just wondering, what's the word for like the language? Is it Romanes?
Romanes, okay. Yeah.
Just double checking.
So Romanes is the word for the language in the language. Whereas in English, you can just say Romani. The Romani language.
Yeah, it's been a blast just learning about that language and trying to translate it into Czech because that's the closest they can show me how to pronounce it.
Yeah. And there's so many different dialects. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I heard it got my friend Angela, she said, oh, what I speak is like Shakespeare. So she's really proud of speaking. But the rest of the group can't. And that's quite interesting for me as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's brilliant. I'm so glad to hear of that experience. Thank you for sharing.
I believe time has been called on questions. There's another event coming hot on the heels of this one. I would like to say, I feel symbolically it would be nice to say something in Romanes to Madi. So, Madi, Miripen, nice to ke tire laci laci lava, shukar lava.
Nice to ke.
Thank you, everyone, for coming to this talk.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast with Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival, Friday the 3rd to Sunday the 12th of July, 2026.